The following is a review of the portfolio management principles designed to address the learning outcome statement set forth by CFA Institute. This topic is also covered in Portfolio Risk and Return, Part 1. The first LOS requires us to calculate and interpret major return measures and describe their appropriate uses. Holding period return is simply the percentage increase in the value of an investment over a given time period and is calculated by dividing the end of period value by the beginning of period value and subtracting 1. The arithmetic mean return is the simple average of a series of periodic returns. It has the statistical property of being an unbiased estimator of the true mean of the underlying distribution of returns. The geometric mean return is a compound annual rate. For example, for returns over 3 annual periods, the geometric mean return is calculated as the third root of the product of 1 plus the period 1 return times 1 plus the period 2 return times 1 plus the period 3 return minus 1. When periodic rates of return vary from period to period, the geometric mean return will have a value less than the arithmetic mean return. The money-weighted rate of return is the internal rate of return on a portfolio based on all of its cash inflows and outflows. To calculate a money-weighted rate of return, consider the beginning value and the additional deposits of cash by the investor to be inflows, and consider withdrawals of cash, interest and dividends, which are additional cash available to be withdrawn, and the ending value to be outflows. Generally, we must use the shortest period between significant cash flows into or out of the account when setting up the internal rate of return calculation. For example, if we use 1 month as our period, entering zero cash flow for months with no cash flows, the internal rate of return calculation will yield a monthly rate of return. In that case, we would need to compound the monthly money-weighted return for 12 months to translate it into an effective annual rate. Gross return refers to the total return on a security portfolio before deducting fees for the management and administration of the investment account. Net return refers to the return after these fees have been deducted. Note that commissions on trades and other costs that are necessary to generate the investment returns are deducted in both gross and net return measures. Pre-tax nominal return refers to the return prior to paying taxes. Dividend income, interest income, short-term capital gains, and long-term capital gains may all be taxed at different rates. After-tax nominal return refers to the return after the tax liability is deducted. Real return is nominal return adjusted for inflation. Consider an investor who earns a nominal return of 7% over a year when inflation is 2%. The investor's approximate real return is approximately 5%. The investor's exact real return is slightly lower, 1.07 divided by 1.02 minus 1, which equals 4.9%. Real return measures the increase in an investor's purchasing power, or how much more goods she can purchase at the end of 1 year due to the increase in the value of her investments. If she invests $1,000 and earns a nominal return of 7%, she will have $1,070 at the end of the year. If the price of the goods she consumes has gone up 2%, she will be able to consume $1,070 divided by 1.02, or 1,049 units. She has given up consuming 1,000 units today, but instead is able to purchase 1,049 units at the end of 1 year. Her purchasing power has gone up 4.9%. This is her real return. A leveraged return refers to a return to an investor that is a multiple of the return on the underlying asset. The leveraged return is calculated as the gain or loss on the investment as a percentage of an investor's cash investment. An investment in a derivative security, such as a futures contract, produces a leveraged return because the cash deposited is only a fraction of the value of the assets underlying the futures contract. Leveraged investments in real estate are very common. Investors pay for only part of the cost of the property with their own cash, and the rest of the amount is paid for with borrowed money. The next LOS is to describe characteristics of the major asset classes that investors consider in forming portfolios. An examination of the returns and standard deviation of returns for the major investable asset classes supports the idea of a trade-off between risk and return. Using U.S. data over the period 1926 to 2008, small capitalization stocks have had the greatest average returns and greatest risk over the period. T-bills had the lowest average returns and the lowest standard deviation of returns. Results for other markets around the world are similar. Asset classes with the greatest average returns also have the highest standard deviation of returns. The annual nominal return on U.S. equities has varied greatly from year to year, ranging from losses greater than 40% to gains of more than 50%. We can approximate the real returns over the period by subtracting inflation. The asset class with the least risk, T-bills, had a real return of only approximately 0.7% over the period, while the approximate real return on U.S. large-cap stocks was 6.6%. Because annual inflation fluctuated greatly over the period, real returns have been much more stable than nominal returns. Evaluating investments using expected return and variance of returns is a simplification because returns do not follow a normal distribution. Distributions are negatively skewed with greater kurtosis than a normal distribution. The negative skew reflects a tendency towards large downside deviations, while the positive excess kurtosis reflects frequent extreme deviations on both the upside and downside. These non-normal characteristics of skewness and kurtosis should be taken into account when analyzing investments. Liquidity is an additional characteristic to consider when choosing investments because liquidity can affect the price and, therefore, the expected return of a security. Liquidity can be a major concern in emerging markets and for securities that trade infrequently, such as low-quality corporate bonds. The next LOS requires us to calculate and interpret the mean, variance, and covariance, or correlation of asset returns, based on historical data. In finance, the variance and standard deviation of returns are common measures of investment risk. Both of these are measures of the variability of a distribution of returns about its mean or expected value. We can calculate the population variance when we know the return for each period, the total number of periods, and the mean or expected value of the population's distribution. Population variance is the sum of the squared deviations from the population mean divided by the number of periods. In the world of finance, we are typically analyzing only a sample of returns data rather than the entire population. To calculate sample variance, we use the sum of the squared deviations from the sample mean divided by the number of periods minus 1. Covariance measures the extent to which two variables move together over time. A positive covariance means that the variables, for example, the rates of return on two stocks, tend to move together. Negative covariance means that the two variables tend to move in opposite directions. A covariance of zero means there is no linear relationship between the two variables. To put it another way, if the covariance of returns between two assets is zero, knowing the return for the next period on one of the assets tells you nothing about the return of the other asset for the period. Here we will focus on the calculation of the covariance between two assets' returns using historical data. The sample covariance is the sum of the products of the two assets' deviations from their sample means in each period, divided by the number of periods minus 1. The magnitude of the covariance depends on the magnitude of the individual stock's standard deviations and the relationship between their co-movements. Covariance is an absolute measure and is measured in return units squared. The covariance of the returns of two securities can be standardized by dividing by the product of the standard deviations of the two securities. This standardized measure of co-movement is called correlation and is computed as covariance divided by the product of the two assets' standard deviations. The correlation coefficient has no units. It is a pure measure of the co-movement of the two stocks' returns and is bounded by negative 1 and positive 1. How should you interpret the correlation coefficient? A correlation coefficient of plus 1 means that deviations from the mean or expected return are always proportional in the same direction. That is, they are perfectly positively correlated. A correlation coefficient of minus 1 means that deviations from the mean or expected return are always proportional in opposite directions. That is, they are perfectly negatively correlated. A correlation coefficient of 0 means that there is no linear relationship between the two stocks' returns. They are uncorrelated. One way to interpret a correlation of 0 is that in any period, knowing the actual value of one variable tells you nothing about the value of the other. The next LOS asks us to explain risk aversion and its implications for portfolio selection. A risk-averse investor is simply one that dislikes risk, preferring less risk to more risk. Given two investments that have equal expected returns, a risk-averse investor will choose the one with less risk. A risk-seeking or risk-loving investor actually prefers more risk to less, and given equal expected returns, will choose the more risky investment. A risk-neutral investor has no preference regarding risk and would be indifferent between two such investments. Consider this gamble. A coin will be flipped. If it comes up heads, you receive $100. If it comes up tails, you receive nothing. The expected payoff is $50. A risk-averse investor would choose a payment of $50, a certain outcome, over the gamble. A risk-seeking investor would prefer the gamble to a certain payment of $50. A risk-neutral investor would be indifferent between the gamble and a certain payment of $50. If expected returns are identical, a risk-averse investor will always choose the investment with the least risk. However, an investor may select a very risky portfolio despite being risk-averse. A risk-averse investor will hold very risky assets if he feels that the extra return he expects to earn is adequate compensation for the additional risk. The next LOS is to calculate and interpret portfolio standard deviation. The variance of returns for a portfolio of two risky assets is calculated as follows. The weight of asset 1 squared times the variance of asset 1 plus the weight of asset 2 squared times the variance of asset 2 plus 2 times the product of the weights times the covariance of assets 1 and 2. The weights of the two assets must sum to 1. Previously, we established that the correlation of returns for two assets is calculated as covariance divided by the product of the two assets' standard deviations. We can also say that covariance is equal to correlation times the product of the standard deviations. We can substitute this term for covariance in the formula for the variance of returns for a portfolio of two risky assets and take the square root of the result to get the standard deviation of a two-asset portfolio. Writing the formula in this form allows us to easily see the effect of the correlation of returns between the two assets on portfolio risk, which we will discuss next. The next LOS asks us to describe the effect on a portfolio's risk of investing in assets that are less than perfectly correlated. If two risky asset returns are perfectly positively correlated, then the portfolio standard deviation of returns is simply a weighted average of the standard deviations of the individual asset returns. A portfolio 25% invested in asset 1 and 75% invested in asset 2 will have a standard deviation of returns equal to 25% of the risk of asset 1's return plus 75% of the risk of asset 2's return. Focusing on returns correlation, we can see that the greatest portfolio risk results when the correlation between asset returns is plus 1. For any value of correlation less than 1, portfolio variance is reduced. For a correlation of 0, the entire third term in the portfolio variance equation is 0. For negative values of correlation, the third term becomes negative and further reduces portfolio variance and standard deviation. Portfolio risk falls as the correlation between the assets' returns decreases. This is an important result of the analysis of portfolio risk. The lower the correlation of asset returns, the greater the risk reduction or diversification benefit of combining assets in a portfolio. If asset returns were perfectly negatively correlated, portfolio risk could be eliminated altogether for a specific set of asset weights. The risk reduction benefits of investing in assets with low return correlations should be clear. The desire to reduce risk is what drives investors to invest in not just domestic stocks, but also bonds, foreign stocks, real estate, and other assets. Our next LOS asks us to describe and interpret the minimum variance and efficient frontiers of risky assets and the global minimum variance portfolio. For each level of expected portfolio return, we can vary the portfolio weights on the individual assets to determine the portfolio that has the least risk. These portfolios that have the lowest standard deviation of all portfolios with a given expected return are known as minimum variance portfolios. Together, they make up the minimum variance frontier. On a risk versus return graph, the portfolio that is farthest to the left has the least risk and is known as the global minimum variance portfolio. Assuming that investors are risk-averse, investors prefer the portfolio that has the greatest expected return when choosing among portfolios that have the same standard deviation of returns. Those portfolios that have the greatest expected return for each level of risk make up the efficient frontier. The efficient frontier coincides with the top portion of the minimum variance frontier. A risk-averse investor would only choose portfolios that are on the efficient frontier because all available portfolios that are not on the efficient frontier have lower expected returns than an efficient portfolio with the same risk. The portfolio on the efficient frontier that has the least risk is the global minimum variance portfolio. The next LOS is to explain the selection of an optimal portfolio given an investor's utility or risk aversion and the capital allocation line. An investor's utility function represents the investor's preferences in terms of risk and return, that is, his degree of risk aversion. An indifference curve is a tool from economics that, in this application, plots combinations of risk and expected return among which an investor is indifferent. In constructing indifference curves for portfolios based on only their expected return and standard deviation of returns, we are assuming that these are the only portfolio characteristics that investors care about. The investor's expected utility is the same for all points along a single indifference curve. Indifference curves slope upward for risk-averse investors because they will only take on more risk if they are compensated with greater expected returns. An investor who is relatively more risk-averse requires a relatively greater increase in expected return to compensate for a given increase in risk. In other words, a more risk-averse investor will have steeper indifference curves reflecting a higher risk aversion coefficient. In our previous illustration of efficient portfolios available in the market, we included only risky assets. Now we will introduce a risk-free asset into our universe of available assets, and we will consider the risk and return characteristics of a portfolio that combines a portfolio of risky assets and the risk-free asset. Recall from quantitative methods that we can calculate the expected return of a portfolio as the weighted average of the expected returns of the assets. Because a risk-free asset has zero standard deviation and zero correlation of returns with those of a risky portfolio, the standard deviation of a portfolio containing a risky asset and a risk-free asset reduces to the weight of the risky asset times its standard deviation. The intuition of this result is quite simple. If we put X percent of our portfolio into the risky asset portfolio, the resulting portfolio will have standard deviation of returns equal to X percent of the standard deviation of the risky asset portfolio. Combining a risky portfolio with a risk-free asset is the process that supports the two-fund separation theorem, which states that all investors' optimum portfolios will be made up of some combination of an optimal portfolio of risky assets and the risk-free asset. The line representing these possible combinations of risk-free assets and the optimal risky asset portfolio is referred to as the capital allocation line. We can combine the capital allocation line with indifference curves representing an individual's preferences for risk and return to illustrate the logic of selecting an optimal portfolio. Among the portfolios that are available in the market, the portfolio that maximizes the investor's expected utility will lie on the capital allocation line at a point that is tangent to the investor's indifference curve. Investors who are less risk-averse will select portfolios that are more risky. Recall that the less an investor's risk aversion, the flatter his indifference curves. A flatter indifference curve results in an optimal portfolio that lies to the right of the one that results from a steeper indifference curve. An investor who is less risk-averse should optimally choose a portfolio with more invested in the risky asset portfolio and less invested in the risk-free asset.